Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Eva Etzioni-Haleve, a retired professor of sociology at the Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv, Israel, is the author of The Song of Hannah, a biblical novel of love, temptation, and the making of a prophet, and the guest in this edition of Radio Curious. The story she tells us takes place in the 11th century B.C., when few people were literate. In this interview with Eva Etzioni-Haleve, recorded from her home in Tel Aviv, Israel, in late September 2006, she describes her interpretation of Hannah's life, loves, and leadership, and about her impressions of Israel several weeks after the summer 2006 war with Lebanon. We began when I asked Eva Etzioni-Haleve to describe who Hannah was.
Well, Hannah is a very well-known and well-loved biblical character. And she's famous for the fact that she couldn't bear a son. She was barren. And eventually she prayed for a son, and her petition was granted, and she became the mother of one of the major personalities in Jewish history, the prophet Samuel.
What do you think she did as the mother of Samuel to contribute to his development that resulted in him being a prophet?
She didn't actually raise him herself. She sent him out to what you might call a school or something like that in the temple.
What did he learn?
I guess he learned the basic tenets of the Judaic faith as it was at the time.
How would you characterize the difference between the Judaic or the Jewish faith 3,000 years ago as compared to now?
Well, I think it's the basis, really. The way it shaped up at the time is the basis of what we actually have today. There was a struggle at the time, which I also describe in the novel, for monotheism. As you probably know, all the other people but the Israelites were idol worshippers. And there was a big struggle going on for hundreds of years, which worldview would prevail, and eventually the monotheistic view prevailed, and this became the basis of Judaism, and later the basis of the Judean Christian tradition, which is really the basis of Western culture today.
The monotheism, or the one God concept.
Yes. So this is what we still have from that time. It came out victorious after several centuries of struggle. But of course, many other things have changed. One of the things, for instance, that very prominently has changed is the sacrifices. At the time, it was considered important, and not only important, but part of the major, let's say, ritual of the Judaic religion to offer sacrifices. And today, that of course would no longer be acceptable to us in any way.
What kind of sacrifices were offered?
Animals. And you must understand that this was very, very widespread in at the time, in the various cultures which existed at the time. And in fact, the Judaic culture was a lot more forward or progressive in the sense that they didn't sacrifice children as many other people did, which was horrifying. But they did sacrifice animals, and of course, today that would be very, very unacceptable to us. So those are, you know, I think that's the main thing that has changed. But of course, there are other things. But I just wanted to refer back to the book and the personalities there. Now, Hannah is the well-known personality, but my identification, my liking was really with the other major woman in the book, whose name is Penina.
Tell us about Penina.
Penina was the woman who had many children, but her husband didn't love her. She was the one who was, great anguish because she was shamed by her husband. Her husband showed everybody that he loved the other wife, Hannah. By the way, this is being read in the Jewish holidays in the synagogue, so that's just the right time for this story to be talked about.
What is the significance of the story in relationship to the Jewish holidays?
I think that the reason that this story was chosen to be read on the Jewish holidays is because it shows the power of prayer. Hannah is praying for a child and her wish is granted, and this is really what the Jewish holidays are, part of what the Jewish holidays are about, praying for mercy from the Almighty, and this is sort of saying that it can happen. In fact, just a little anecdote that some of the women who read my book said the reason I was interested in your book, and several women said that to me, was that I had a very similar experience. A Hannah miracle happened to me. I couldn't conceive a child for many years, and then one year came to the synagogue and I prayed, and it was like a miracle happened, and a year later I had a son or a daughter, and one of them even called him Samuel. So this idea of praying and what prayer can actually do to you is one of the basic tenets of the basic themes of the Jewish holidays, and I think that this is why it was chosen, this particular story.
In addition to being a novelist, you are a sociologist, a retired sociologist. Can you comment from the perspective of a sociologist about the social effect of prayer on what somebody might hope to be able to do, in this case, conceive a child?
Well, I would say that this is more perhaps psychological rather than sociological, but it's a well-known fact that there are quite a few women who cannot conceive when they are not at peace with themselves. If they feel guilty, if there's something bothering them, worrying them. So the prayer in itself, I think, is sort of a catharsis. People feel that somehow something happens inside when you pray that makes you feel at peace. In addition, the prayer itself, and this is very important in Judaism, the prayer in itself is not good unless it's also accompanied by repentance. And this is one of the things that I emphasize in my novel, The Song of Hannah, that Hannah couldn't really conceive because she did feel guilty. She felt guilty about what she had done to her rival, to Penina, taking away the love of her husband. And only when she repented about that could she actually conceive. So I think this is a psychological concept there.
But didn't you imply that her husband, Elkanah, was not in love with Penina? So perhaps Hannah didn't really take away his love.
Well, in the Bible, it doesn't actually say which of the wives was the first one. In the novel, I described it in the manner that Penina was the first one, and Hannah came in, barged in, and sort of the moment he saw Hannah, he fell in love with her. And Penina felt that she had been hurt by Hannah taking away her man. And at some point, Hannah becomes full of guilt feelings about this, and she cannot conceive until she actually is at peace with herself. She decides never to hurt Penina again, to help her and so forth, and only then can she conceive. I think this is that in a way there are women who feel that way today also after 3,000 years feel the idea of conception being connected with peace of mind, with not being in conflict with other people and so forth, that this is a modern idea as well as an ancient one.
So give us your perspective on that concept from the point of view of a sociologist.
From the point of view of a sociologist, what I could say here is really that there was a family structure which polygamous, as you probably know, and we find that in the Bible many times, several times, where there are two wives and one husband. And this sort of family structure just begs for conflict and for jealousy and for enmity between the two or more wives of the same husband, and we find it again and again. So it really, the guilt feelings come in a way from this family structure, because once there are two women in the same household vying for the love of the same man, then you're bound to have things like this happening. But it also, it's very interesting that after 3,000 years, there were still women who told me when they had read the book that they felt they had very similar experiences to that of Pnina, that their husbands fell in love with other women because they couldn't marry them. But they did have them sort of on the side until they found out, and then they got back at their husbands in the way that Pnina did to her husband, which means by finding another man. finding like another, and that this is not outmoded yet today, that things like that do happen. Even though the family structure has changed, this problem of a wife being unloved by her husband is still with us.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think love is not something that you can control. A man can love one woman at one time, and suddenly he meets another woman, and then he's attracted to her, and that just happens. It happens, in fact, quite a bit. I just had a talk last night about the book, and one of the ladies there said, you know, there are many, many, many husbands who have somebody on the side, and the wives don't know about it, or when they find out, they have to make a decision about whether they want to go on with their husbands or whether they want to take to go for a divorce or whatever, you know, and this... This just happens because of the human nature, the way it is.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Eva Etzioni Haleve, the author of The Song of Hannah, from her home in Tel Aviv, Israel. She is a retired professor of sociology and a survivor of the Holocaust, having been born in Vienna, Austria. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Eva, do you have any considerations or any thoughts as to why polygamy exists in the sense that a man may have more than one wife, and that overrides the fact that a woman may have more than one husband?
Why does it happen more often in history and even today? There are still societies like this. Because men are more powerful. Evidently, it was at that time, and it still is today to some extent, a patriarchal society. And all the societies that exist today where there's still polygamy, men are very powerful, women are not. And this is, I think, very, very obvious in the Bible, that... The type of family structure and social structure that existed gave men a lot of power, and the women just had to accept their lot. But it's also interesting, and I try to show this in the novel, that the women, although they did not have much power socially, they were strong in their character. you look at the biblical, different biblical women like Sarah and Rebecca and so forth, you see they were quite strong women. They always found some niche or some way to get what they wanted in the spirit of having to cope in a male-dominated social structure, but finding ways of doing it by their own inner strengths and also by bonding together to the sisterhood of women. This is one of the messages that I try to convey in the book, is that those two women, at the beginning, they were enemies, but somehow they... at the beginning they were friends, then they became enemies when Hannah married the same man as Nina, and they sort of hated each other, but then they became friends again. And they started to protect each other and support each other, and this is the way they could stand up to the men in their life. In their lives.
All of the men, or just their husband?
Well, first of all, of course, the husband. They both had the same husband who was very, very powerful over both of them. But then later on, when the prophet Samuel grows up, then he becomes another character in the story, and the two women have to cope with their relationship with this young man as well, which is a very complex relationship. And I don't want to give away the story in case somebody wants to read the book, but Prophet Samuel is subject to a sinful temptation, to a sinful love, and part of the story has to do with how he copes with this, of how his mother and his the other wife of his father cope with his the way he relates to them.
Eva Etzioni Haleve, let's digress from your book, The Song of Hannah, and talk about what's going on in Israel. It's now several weeks after there was a truce in the war in the summer of 2006, the war with Lebanon. Tell us what's going on now in Israel.
Thanks God, the war is over for the moment, and we all hope that the calm that we have now will continue. But the situation in Israel is not brilliant. I have to say that there's a lot of internal strife going on. Not about the war itself, because there was consensus, almost complete consensus, that there was no choice. Israel was actually attacked, and there was no choice but to react. But the strife is about the way the war was conducted.
What is that strife? Can you describe it for us?
Well, there are demonstrations all practically every day. People demonstrate and against the political leadership, against the military leadership. Just yesterday or a couple of days ago, there was a conference of the ruling party, Kadima, and people barged in and started to denigrate the prime minister, and they practically disrupted the conference. And this is going on almost day after day, day after day.
How would you describe the position of the prime minister and the position of the people who are opposed to the prime minister?
I think the position of the prime minister is not good. He's like Bush, but perhaps even worse than Bush. He's plummeting in the public opinion service. He's just saw a survey today which showed that only 7% of the public want him as prime minister. I mean, that's not very good.
What is he seeking to do that the Israeli people object to?
They first of all object to the way he conducted the war. I mean, this is really the major thing. The war is still very prominent in Israel's consciousness, and quite a few people, soldiers, fell in the war. In Israel, every soldier is considered a child, and you know that it hurts very badly when anybody is killed. But in this case, they argue that many were killed for no reason at all, that the war was not conducted correctly, that many casualties could have been saved, that a lot of things like that. Of course, I'm not a military person, I cannot say, but one thing is for sure, the army was not prepared for war. And if the army is not prepared for war, there's no point in the war breaking, you know, breaking out, making it happen when the army is not capable of doing the best it can.
When you say that the support for the prime minister is about 6% of the population.
That's what one of the surveys I saw today showed.
That would lead one to believe that the vast majority of the Israeli population believe that the war was not proper. What is your feeling about how the Israelis would characterize what should have been done?
As I said, I don't think they think the war was not proper. I think they believe it was not conducted in a proper way.
But how should it have been conducted?
Well, not everybody agrees with that. Some people, I think everybody agrees that the army was not prepared. You know, Prime Minister's chief responsibility here in Israel is to have the army prepared for whatever might happen.
How could it have been? How could the army have been prepared differently? What would the result have been?
The result would have been fewer casualties. I'll just give you one example. The tanks were not really protected properly. They could have, with investment of some money, again, I'm not a military person, but they could have fortified the tanks in such a way that when they got shot at, they wouldn't have collapsed. And so lots of people's lives would have been saved. But for some reason or other, they didn't invest the money that was necessary to protect the tanks, to fortify the tanks. So that's just one example of many.
So do I hear you correctly in that the Israeli people feel that the army should have been better prepared and better fortified, but that the what the army was doing in relationship to the attacks from Lebanon were justified?
I think there's about 90% consensus that the army going to war, that Israel going to war was justified in view of what the Hezbollah did, abducting soldiers, killing soldiers. There was no provocation whatsoever. Israel was within its borders, living peacefully, everybody doing their own thing. There was no provocation, and the Hezbollah just attacked. So obviously Israel cannot just let its people be led like lambs to the slaughter. So there was a consensus, and there still is a consensus, that the war was absolutely necessary.
What was Hezbollah's motivation, from your perspective?
That's a very good question. I wish I knew. You know, many people in Israel are really wondering why. Why? I mean, Israel did nothing at all to provoke Nasrallah. Why did he attack? One hypothesis I can present is that he has to justify his existence. It's a terrorist organization that has fortified itself with enormous amounts of weapons, and then it has to show that it's doing something. Otherwise, why does it exist? People will start asking, what do we need it for?
So what then, with that in mind, do you see as the future of Israel in the years to come?
It's a very good question, and I don't have any very good answer. I mean, the main thing to emphasize is that Hezbollah is merely a front for Iran. It's being armed, and the money comes from Iran. So the main threat that Israel is now facing is not the Palestinians, but Iran. And the president of Iran has very openly said that he wants to destroy Israel. He's getting to be close to having nuclear weapons, and it looks like a major threat. So the question is, how can this threat be diminished, at least? I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think there's anybody who has the solution to that. It doesn't seem as the West, that the West is willing to do anything against this man. The West turns out to be one big Chamberlain, when what we need is a big Churchill. That's what I think personally, that the West is just caving in to Iran the way Chamberlain caved in to Hitler.
What do you think the West should do?
Well, start with sanctions. And real sanctions, not equivocating. Maybe this, that. Can we have negotiations? Can we think about it? Can we just give in to them on this and not on that? I mean, that's not going to lead to anything. I may be wrong, but at the moment it looks rather bad. I mean, the sanctions. Perhaps, maybe they could convince Iran to drop its nuclear weapons programs. Of course, there's no certainty, but that's what I think the West should do.
Well, Eva Etzioni Haleve, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious from your home in Tel Aviv, Israel. And I'd like to close by asking you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Right. I have a book I like very much, and it's called Walking the Bible by Bruce Filler, I think the name. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. And it's a book describing a journey the author took through all the lands of the Bible. I find it a fascinating book. It puts you in touch with the Bible. With the land, with the places where the things took place. It's not only a physical journey, but it's a spiritual journey. When you read the book, you can feel that you're actually touching those places. You can feel that you're reliving what's happening, what happened at that time. So I would highly recommend it.
Eva Etzioni Haleve, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
And thank you.
Eva Etzioni Haleve is a retired professor of sociology at Bar Ilan University in Tel Aviv, Israel, and the author of The Song of Hannah, a biblical novel of love, temptation, and the making of a prophet. The book she recommends is Walking the Bible by Bruce Filler. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.